My name's Alan Barclay. I'm an accredited practicing dietitian, and I'm here to talk about health and nutrition with Dr. Vivian Miller. Vivian.
Hello, how are you, Alan?
Very
I'm
good,
Dr.
thanks.
Vivian Miller. Good. I'm Dr. Vivian Miller. I'm primarily a GP. I have done a lot of different types of medicine. I have a special interest in diet, nutrition, diabetes, weight loss, lifestyle, and cardiology. And general medicine. So that's a little bit about me. Alan, would you like to say something about yourself?
Yes, well, I'm an accredited practicing dietitian. I've got over 30 years of experience in clinical dietetics, so I see patients, public health. I worked for Diabetes Australia New South Wales for 16 years, and academia. I did a PhD at the University of Sydney in carbohydrate and risk of chronic diseases. So that's probably enough for me.
So we're doing these podcasts because we want to educate the general public. I was thinking about this the other night, and I was thinking it's really a good mix because you being a doctor of dietitian and nutrition, and you've got the academic side, you also have the clinical side, and I've got the medical side and also the clinical side. So we cover a lot of bases. So my first question to you then, Alan, is what do you think about the weight loss medications that are injectable?
Yeah, no, great question, Vivian. And as we both know, they're becoming increasingly popular here in Australia and many other parts of the world. And of course, we both see patients. I'm sure you may have prescribed it for some patients. I am on the other end of the table, so to speak, and I see people that have been prescribed them. And, you know, by and large, in those people that can tolerate them, they're quite successful. And certainly help people to lose weight. But as well known, it was picked up in the randomized controlled trials. There's some very common side effects from nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea in the short term, and getting the right dose to be clinically effective from that perspective is important. And the other thing that I see, because I often see people some time after they've been prescribed these medications, is that people are just not eating particularly well. And this is despite the fact that, again, the clinical trials, they had health coaches or dietitians or diabetes educators or exercise physiologists, all of the above, who actually provided healthy eating advice and also physical activity advice. So the drugs are actually supposed to be used as an adjunct to a healthy lifestyle. They're not supposed to be used on their own. But often I see people who basically just taking the drugs and they're really just cutting out food in general. Maybe it's the first few meals of the day, they might be eating one meal a day, and they're not necessarily nutritionally balanced. And that's where the alarm bells start going off in my head, because as we know, the weight loss and people are only using, you know, usually their home scales, in kilograms, about 40% of that could be muscle or other lean body mass. So people just think about, oh, I've lost so-and-so kilos and isn't it wonderful? But they can become nutritionally compromised. It can actually affect their nutritional status. They can increase their malnourishment. And that's quite important because a lot of people with existing obesity can actually be malnourished. And I think people don't appreciate that, you know, because they may not have been eating well already. They may be deficient in various vitamins and minerals. And then cutting out their food even further can just exacerbate that. So there's a lot of issues. So yes, in summary, they work, but people have to be careful. They're not meant to be used by themselves.
Yes, I see a lot of the problems you've mentioned in clinical practice. I have concerns especially about certain personality types who use it as a quick fix. You know, there's a lot of people who are desperate and they don't have the education to put in the work. I think it's very important that if the doctor prescribing these medications, and they should be prescribed by a doctor, you can get them, of course, over the internet and from friends and other ways of doing it, which are not advisable because of side effects that you may not be aware of until they happen. So the problem in this situation is that if you use these medications, you need to really have a doctor prescribing them who's interested in explaining in detail, and by detail, I don't mean just telling you to eat more calcium, eat more vegetable and fiber. I mean actually sitting down with you, going through with you what you eat for breakfast, lunch, dinner, what you drink, snacks, whether you smoke, how much you exercise, you know, doing an overhaul of your actual lifestyle. And if the GP or doctor prescribing these medications is not doing that, I think it's absolutely vital that you ask for a referral to a dietitian. That should be offered by any doctor prescribing these medications who's not comfortable to do that. So that's my feeling. And the reason for this is that I see so many patients, you put them on the medication, they lose the weight, they're very excited. And I may add at this point that not everybody loses weight on these medications. So we can talk about that in a minute. And you do another history of their diet and their lifestyle a month in, and suddenly they're missing breakfast, they're having a piece of fruit for morning tea, they're having a salad for lunch, and they're having meat and two veg for dinner, and not much, or they're having, you know, a simple curry and rice, or whatever it happens to be, and they're losing fiber, which people don't appreciate is highly necessary to avoid constipation and problems associated with the gut generally. And it also makes you feel fuller longer, fiber. They're deficient in calcium, which is important because of loss of bone mass in the long term especially. And they're also often deficient in fruit and especially vegetables. So cooked vegetables lose vitamins and minerals. So salad is mainly water. So you have to have a lot of fresh vegetables as part of the salad if you want to be healthy. So those are the main issues that I see. What do you see in your practice?
Yeah, no, I echo the same issues, Vivian. And I think the first thing that I do, so yes, I certainly take a very thorough diet history and recall to find out exactly what people are eating now. And then you really have to encourage them because their appetite is suppressed. And I totally agree with you, these medications don't work for everybody. Randomized controlled trials, so about 80% of those that go on those, but in the real world it's sort of down to about a quarter to a third depending on the real world scenario that you look at. So getting back to practicals, so making sure that people, I try and get them to eat three meals a day, and I say, you know, even if you're not feeling hungry, to try and make yourself have something and try and make that something that goes down fairly easily, particularly in the morning. A lot of people don't feel hungry in the morning anyway, partly I think because of insulin resistance.
No, I know what you mean.
Story. Yeah. But, you know, so and having, you know, some form of protein. Now, I think people think when they think protein, they tend to think meat. But, of course, there are lots of vegetarian alternatives, whether that's eggs or cheese. But even vegan if you prefer. So the soy protein is actually very good quality protein. It has a very high biological value. It's equivalent to many animal proteins. So it doesn't have to be meat. And it could be in the form of, say, you know, a simple breakfast cereal. So porridge is one of those breakfasts that I recommend. Obviously in winter time it's best, but in summertime you can have a muesli, an untoasted muesli, which is just an oat anyway. So, and if you have it with a quality milk, whether that's cow milk or a soy equivalent, then you're going to get high quality protein anyway, or maybe some yogurt. So there are many things that you can have. They're just a few examples. Then a good lunch, and yes, the old salad, I mean, it's good from some perspectives, but again, it doesn't have any protein. So if you add some cheese perhaps, or some egg, or, you know, seafood, and not to get the feta is great, like a Greek salad. You've got to think of, you know, overarching principles too. It's got to have some, you know, essential fatty acids are much overlooked. And I do, when I do diet histories, I find that most Australians don't have enough essential fatty acids. So seafood's quite important if you like it. If you don't, then, you know, there's a few sources. Eggs are quite good. But also canola oils and margarines are actually a source of omega-3 for those that are vegetarian or vegan. So, you know, there's things that you can do. And then dinner, yes, often it is the meat and three veg, and that's fine if it's a good quality meat and they're good quality vegetables or a salad. So it's usually the main meal of the day that's okay. It's the breakfast and lunch that's really neglected, And therefore, that's going to increase people's risk of malnourishment and what you alluded to. I mean, when you talk about lean body mass, we're not just talking about muscles, but yes, it's bone and it's organ mass as well. And we've got to think of the long-term consequences because, as we know now, if you stop taking these medications, you regain weight fairly rapidly. And partly, I think, when you look at the data, it's because people are losing more muscle mass because they haven't eaten well and they haven't been physically active. And therefore, that slows down their metabolic rate. And therefore, when they go back to their ordinary eating patterns, once they've stopped the medications, the weight comes back on really quickly. So you've got two choices there, of course. You continue to take these medicines if you can afford to, or if you want to, and that's a different discussion. Otherwise, you've really got to make sure you eat well and are physically active. Otherwise, in the long run, you are going to have some health problems.
I'm just going to add something in there, you know, a quick calculation. Over 10 years, you can easily spend $36,000 Australian on these medications.
Yeah.
Just a thought, just
yeah.
a thought.
No, it's a very important
and I don't
point.
Think you're saving,
yeah.
You know, I don't think you're saving that money on food. But anyway,
well,
I think it would be very, very, I think it would be very reasonable to actually just very briefly talk about how to get enough fiber in your diet in the morning. Porridge is a good soluble fiber, so it helps push motions along. It can form some motions, but you have to form a motion to be able to push it along. So chia seeds, psyllium husks can add fiber to porridge and make it even more effective at bulking out stools. And you can have it with a bit of milk or yogurt or something along those lines. To increase the calcium in the morning, and that's one good option. You know, fruit for morning tea, fruit for afternoon tea, that covers your fruit for the day. Your salad, you need to have dairy products again. So as you suggested, cheese on the salad. And salad's fine, but make it a nice big salad with lots of tomatoes, cucumber, you know, lots of salad vegetables that are fresh because of vitamins. They take up very little calories. But you do get multivitamins out of these and things that you can't get from a tablet. I'm a firm believer in not taking a multivitamin tablet unless you are advised to by a doctor or a dietitian, or unless you have specific medical problems where it's obviously necessary.
Agreed.
Pregnancy, malabsorption,
yep.
few odds and ends. We need to go back to first principles and change our diet so that we have a natural lifestyle.
Yep.
When you look at dinner, this idea of meat and three veg, I'm going to throw something out there. I'm vegetarian. I get disappointed if I have less than six types of vegetable for dinner. And I think I've let my family down because you need to have different types of vegetable. And I think it's quite easy to have more than three types. It doesn't take much effort to put a bit of pumpkin in with some potato or sweet potato. To put some beans or corn in with peas, and you've immediately doubled your amount of vegetables. So just a thought, and it also fills you up for longer as well. And again, these things, cauliflower, broccoli, peas, they don't have many calories in them. Dessert, again, you can have a piece of cheese with your fruit. So if you do that, you pretty well cover your fiber, your protein. If you're vegetarian, you obviously would prefer to have eggs or beans. Or as you say, soy protein, and there's some really good fungal proteins, soy proteins, wheat proteins out there in the market, certainly in Australia and hopefully in other countries overseas. You've got lentils, you've got beans. There's a lot of options around for vegetarians as a general rule.
Yep.
So you mentioned the people that don't lose weight on these, and I mentioned them as well. And that's a really upsetting group. What can we offer them, do you think?
Well, there are many roads to Rome. Some people can take what's known as a very low energy diet, and that is available through your pharmacist only. It's not the shakes that you find in your supermarket. You can only get very low energy diets through your pharmacist. They are total meal replacements, and if you do them well, then you can lose 2 to 3 kilograms of weight per week if you're a strongly adherent. But you don't just take the shakes by themselves. Again, you need to have lots of vegetables, not so much fruit, but vegetables to keep the bowels and also the gallbladder going. So you need a few, again, you need essential fats there, whether it's canola or linseed or flaxseed oil or whatever, to keep the bowels and gallbladder going. But they are quite useful, and they've, of course, have been used in the diabetes remission trials, and for up to 6 months for that purpose. And you can lose up to 15% of your body weight, which, you know, we're sort of talking the levels that you see with these injectables at the moment. So it is possible, but like injectables, they're not for everybody either. And then the other
No.
option, you know, is a low energy diet, and this is best done in consultation with your dietitian, is one that can be as low as 1,000 calories or 4,200 kilojoules a day, which is quite low. The very low energy diets are 800 or 3,350 kilojoules a day. So it's getting close to that. But this is, of course, eating real foods. But again, it has to be very
Yes.
carefully designed so that you don't become deficient in any vitamin, mineral, or fiber or essential fatty acids. So it can be done with real food. But it's best to personalize that, you know, so I can't really give broad descriptions. It's best that you see somebody, go through what you're eating, and then work out with the health professional the best option for you, because you might be vegetarian like yourself, Vivian, or you might be of a certain religious faith. You might not eat specific foods for religious reasons, what have you. So it really is best that you see somebody and work out something that's culturally, religiously, and also personally appropriate for you, not just to start taking the shakes or whatever else and that's all
Yes.
you'll do. I think it's really about, because
yes.
food is not just medicine.
Education.
It has, you know, cultural and social and even hedonic purposes in life, and we must sort of take all of those into consideration. Otherwise, you're just not going to stay with this. You know, you might do it for 6 months, and that's what all of the randomized controlled trials show. You know, they're all wonderful at 6 months, but come 12, you've gone back to where you started because you just can't stick to it.
And I think there's a couple of other options medically for people who are unable to lose weight with a weight loss diet and who may not have the self-control or motivation or just bloody mindedness, really, to stick with a very low-calorie diet, because that really is a big decision for a lot of people. I guess the side effects of those things are feeling hypoglycemic if you don't have diabetes in particular. If you do have diabetes, you're going to have to change your medications or insulin regimen to match. So again, this is where it comes back to seeing a doctor when you go on these types of diets. They're very effective, and before you have weight loss surgery, reputable doctors will insist that you stay on those for at least 2 months to lose abdominal fat prior to surgery. So, and also to make sure that you have the willpower and the motivation to stick with the restrictions after surgery. So again, we've got the weight loss, the very low calorie diets, and the surgery. There's a couple of options that I use in general practice. In Australia, we have the commonest options would be Topamax, topiramide, which is an old-fashioned, it's not that old-fashioned now, but it's getting there. It's about 30 years old, migraine medication and anti-epileptic. And that can blunt your appetite. And I have had some patients, especially if they're motivated to have a healthy diet that's lower in calories, and especially if they're able to exercise a bit, it doesn't give you low blood glucose, so you don't get hypoglycemic, you don't feel faint on it or lightheaded. It doesn't have that big an effect. It's not like the injectables or the stimulant medications. But you can certainly use that. And especially if you don't have to lose a large amount of weight, it's quite suitable for patients who may have a BMI of about 30, 32, that sort of thing. And it's really reasonably good with side effects. So that's one option. The other option, which I often use for patients that tend to eat more in the day because it doesn't work for the patients that binge in the evenings, would be something along the lines of phentermine, which is an appetite suppressant. And I don't usually use a large dose of that. I always start on the low dose and build up because the side effects of those can be feeling a bit jittery, headachy, fast pulse rates, you know, can mimic an anxiety thing. So you have to warn patients about that. As I say, patients who binge in the evenings when they're relaxed after dinner, and I sympathize with you, believe me, those patients would be better off not having anything in the house that is high in calories, that is unhealthy for you, and just not buying these things so that they're just not there to eat. So that if you're hungry in the evening and you want something sweet, you're basically stuck with putting some sugar in some natural yogurt or having some low-fat yogurt with fruit or something along those lines, and celery sticks and cream cheese, low-fat cream cheese, that sort of thing. Instead of having biscuits, cakes, learn to cook healthy foods if you do insist on having these sorts of things. Again, I'm a great fan of chia seeds in replacement of flour and almond meal in replacement of flour. So the appetite suppressors work well for patients who tend to snack a lot during the day. And again, you don't need to use a large dose, and I think in theory you shouldn't need to. But for patients that weigh a bit more, that the injectables aren't working for, those are good options, but you don't see the large amounts of weight loss that you do with the injectables or with the low-calorie diets, very low-calorie diets. So they're a better option for a lot of patients. So I guess that leads us to a few other odds and ends. Is there anything else that you'd like to cover at this point, Alan?
I think it's really interesting about the long-term consequences of all of these options within. So maybe you'd like to start the discussion on that from a medical perspective.
Yes, they're unknown. They're known with the weight loss measures of medication. For example, fenfluramine. They're known with very low-calorie diets because they're short-term use. They can't be used long-term because you just can't stick on it. They're also known with weight loss surgery, which, of course, is a permanent thing. So that causes permanent changes, and the nutritional aspects of that are quite significant. They should not be underestimated, especially gastric sleeve. You get B12 deficiency, tendency to iron deficiency, sometimes fat malabsorption, depending on the type of weight loss surgery that you've had. So, sorry about the tail, everyone, going across my face. So as far as the injectable medications go, the side effects long-term, we think, are likely to be in the order of osteoporosis. That's my concern. My concern is the loss of muscle mass, especially in middle-aged patients, because that's the time of your life where you should be maximizing your muscle mass for when you get a bit older. If you lose muscle mass significantly in middle age, and then you're going to go into your 60s and 70s with less muscle mass, and that's a really big problem for extended lifespan. So you're trading off the shortened lifespan you'd have with the obesity that you are now hopefully getting rid of, but you need to concentrate on exercise to build up your muscles, and I don't believe in rapidly escalating injectable medications for no good reason. If you are losing weight on low-dose injectable medications, I would not be increasing the dose. That's my personal feeling. Money aside, I think you only go up to the higher dose if you have to. And hopefully, if you do that, then you're not going to lose too much weight too fast. But a lot of doctors will automatically increase, and I'm not sure that that's a good idea for the long-term issues. We don't know. We don't know. And you mentioned earlier on some possibilities that are quite frightening that we just don't know about long-term, whether it changes your metabolism, in some ways, cell structure, things along those lines. We don't know. So how long do you think that people should stay on these medications, Alan? Because in America, they're talking about for life because of the rebound weight gain.
Yeah, look, I think that's the $64,000 question, Vivian, and there are definitely advocates recommending that people continue with these drugs for life. I take their point.
I'm not one of them.
Yeah. obesity is a chronic disease, and if people with diabetes take medicine for life, if you've got blood pressure, they take it for life. So that's their train of thought. But I guess we don't know. As you said, we know the outcomes in the long term for a lot of the other methods because they've been around for many decades. We just don't know what the long-term consequences are. And my personal concern, other than ones you've already raised, maybe effects on the gut microbiome and gut health in general. We know it increases the risk of pancreatitis. So are we going to affect, and also if you're not having enough dietary fiber, if your bowel motions are not as frequent as they were, will it have effects on the structure of the bowel, diverticulosis? Will there be longer term risks increasing for bowel cancer because of slow transit of food through the gastrointestinal tract, but also potentially if you're having a higher protein diet, particularly a higher animal protein diet? So there are lots of potential things, but we just don't know. So I think we do need to be cautious. We have to accept that people are continuing to take these drugs and will no doubt do so, and help support them to have a healthy lifestyle to minimize the risk of any of these potential complications as best we can. Nothing is without risk, obviously. So, and it's about weighing them up and having an open discussion so that people can make an informed decision, I think, about, you know, whether they should or shouldn't continue to take them for time immemorial, which is potentially what could be the case with certainly what's happening in the United States. But I think you raised one other question. Sorry, you want to add to that before we... I was going to get back to cost, which you had a nice little summary there. And I mean, for some people, these medications are subsidized through our pharmaceutical benefit scheme here in Australia, and obviously equivalents in other parts of the world.
I'll just stop you there. Actually, they're only subsidized for diabetic patients who have certain criteria. So not all patients with diabetic conditions.
Yeah, sure.
And it's fairly strict. Unfortunately, it's not that practical, which is a shame. And the levels aren't as high that you can go to as well with those medications.
Right.
But I don't know about overseas, but that's just
guidelines. Right. And I believe they've just announced that people with certain cardiovascular conditions will also be allowed to use them under PBS in Australia, but that will be
not
very, very, very stringent. So a lot of people are having them on private script, which is another option, which is about $135 a week or an injection, but I think that's the low dose, and the higher the dose, the more expensive that is. And I don't think our private health insurance scheme covers it beyond that. So there's a great cost, and I just raise that, not giving exact numbers, but to put it into context. So a very low energy diet is probably going to cost you about $55 a week. So it's about half.
And you save on the food.
You're saving on the food. And you still have to eat with these injectables. So, you know, there's food costs on top of their use. So it is actually quite economically feasible to go on a very low energy diet. And if you're following just a low energy diet, again, you know, if you're doing it right, you are eating less foods. And people have this general misunderstanding that healthy foods cost more, but they don't in Australia. They may in other parts of the world, but they certainly don't in this country. So, you know, you can eat healthily on a budget. So eating well is certainly a more cost-effective strategy. Obviously, you know, you do need support and you do need physical activity and you need the time to do so. But I think, you know, we need to take the economic consequences of all of these actions into account. It's not just about, I think people ultimately think about kilograms on the scales, particularly at this time of the year, but it's much more important to think of long-term effects and the costs of what we're doing to ourselves. So.
And on the subject of exercise, you know, if you can, try some vigorous exercise an hour a day, if you have time. If you're working part-time, you should definitely be able to make that sort of time. And I would go so far as to say even more time if you're working part-time and you don't have any responsibilities. If you have kids, take the kids with, you know, take the husband with. You do things as a family. I think you have to remember that weight gain of muscle will weigh more than fat does. So that may be one reason why people don't lose much weight on any form of diet. And that's a common complaint you see in general practice, that they're going to the gym five times a week and they're not losing any weight. we don't have to go to the gym. Nature is wonderful, and it's better for your mental health, I think, as a general rule, to be out in nature if you can get out in nature. And, you know, it's good for animals, take your dog with, take your kids with. It's good for family bonding. Walk really fast. Maximize the time that you have. Exercise as comfortably and fast as you can. It's a very important part of weight loss. It triggers the metabolism to drive glucose into the muscle. It lowers your total glucose. It's particularly important for patients with diabetes, for diabetic control. It's got a lot of benefits generally, not just for weight. And I think the other thing that I'd like to just say, just to summarize, is that the injectable medications are probably the best bet for really overweight people, what we call a horrible term, but the morbidly obese. The people who have medical problems because of their weight gain, you know, sleep apnea, they have trouble with chafing and they can't move around easily. Patients who have very, very few other options. Patients who know that they don't have the self-control to stick to any form of low-calorie diet, especially, you know, if they have no support in that respect. So I think that is a very important possibility for those patients. If possible, for the other patients, I would prefer that people try natural ways first and willpower. If that isn't working, I think go to the doctor and get assessed and see what the doctor suggests. And as I say, fenteramine and Topamax. We don't have buprenorphine in this country for weight loss, but it is used overseas. There's a medication called Contrave, which is along those lines. So in Australia we have that, but it is not feasible from the expense point of view compared to the weight loss medications that are injectable. The weight loss with those medications is not as great. Okay.
Nice summary, Vivian, and I totally agree with you what you said about physical activity, and kilograms on the scales are a very crude measure. Get that tape measure out and measure it around your middle. There's a much better marker. That'll get away with that that myth again about exercise not benefiting your weight. It's more about body composition. Yeah. But we've really run out of time now, so I think we'll have
Thank
to
you.
Say goodbye for this episode and look forward to catching up with you.
Yes,
in a few weeks' time on our next topic. So thanks, Vivian.
Okay. Bye.
See you later.